Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We're going to begin this hour with the tragedy and terror in the newsroom. Five people gunned down at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland yesterday. But as the staff grieves for colleagues killed right in front of them, they still have a job to do. As one reporter tweeted yesterday, "We are putting out a damn paper tomorrow." And they did. This hour on Point, a community newsroom carries on after five of their own are murdered. Later this hour, as scheduled, we will have our conversation about summer reading. But first, the tragedy in Maryland. Joining me now from Denver, Colorado, is David Folkenflik. He's NPR's media correspondent. He also fills in as host on this program. David, welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you.
Good to join you.
I'm sorry it's under these circumstances. I'd like to get your reaction to this terrible story. I know you used to work at the Baltimore Sun. You competed against the Capitol Gazette. Rob Hyacin, one of the victims, I understand is an old friend of yours. So I'd like to just first start by asking you about him. Tell us about Rob Hyacin.
Gosh, you're really getting me there.
I'm sorry about that.
That's all right. Rob was this enormous, lovely, loving guy. He was, you know, the word that came to mind to me last night was he's like a Labrador. You know, he just bounded over the newsroom with this infectious energy. I used to sit just a couple desks from him for years in the feature section of the Baltimore Sun. A quick smile, a quick laugh, a question about a story. Is there a way to make it better? Is there a voice being left out? Is there some way in which to recognize the humanity in the people that you were writing about or he was writing about or a story that was being overlooked? A guy who would both inform readers and kind of quietly mentor colleagues, sometimes younger colleagues and sometimes, you know, those of us who are, you know, his peers just working alongside him. He just loved the craft and wanted to find new ways to do it. I remember he was applying to what was a very prestigious journalism fellowship, the Stanford Knight Fellowship. And to give you a sense of his just cheerful relentlessness, you know, these are very competitive. Maybe a dozen people get chosen from the U.S. each year to go and study and be subsidized to think about ways of doing journalism. At that time, he really was thinking about narrative and his craft. And he was turned down. And then a year or two later, he applied again. He was turned down again. And I swear to God, he did it again. And I talked once to the head of the program. And they said, "We love this guy. We had to find a way to get him in here." You know, and in for readers and journalists in Palm Beach and in Florida, where he worked for many years, in Baltimore, where he worked with me and with others so well and so cheerfully for many years, and in Annapolis as a columnist, but also as a mentor to younger reporters, they're really challenging them in a persistent and yet relentlessly upbeat way. You know, he was bestowing a gift pretty much daily. I just couldn't be fonder of him.
Well, it's a lovely remembrance, and what a loss. The other victims, I want to mention their names, Wendy Winters, Rebecca Smith, Gerald Fishman, and John McNamara. David, what do you know about them, about their work?
You know, these were people that I didn't know myself, and yet the stories that emerge in the last painful 24 hours show people who give you a sense of the texture of, you know, not some distant media elite, not some people who hold themselves apart from the community, but people invested in the daily warp and woof of what it is to live in a small city like Annapolis in Anne Arundel County there in Maryland, trying to chronicle people's lives make sure that, you know, as public radio do, you know, good community journalism reflects people in their own words and voices in ways that they can recognize, explores the tough problems that exist, hold people accountable. You know, there's this great line in the Tribune that was written by my old colleague Gene Marbella in the Baltimore Sun, which is the larger sister paper to the Annapolis Capitol these days, about one of the I guess actually Gene didn't write this one, but there's a tribute, a lovely one written to this Gerald Fishman, who was a fairly quirky guy. He kept his own hours. He often left post-it notes for colleagues rather than communicating directly. But he took his responsibilities writing editorials so seriously that, as one person put it, a politician put it, you know, when he was being interviewed for endorsements for city council, it was taken as seriously as though he was running for United States Senate seat. That he really, you know, wanted to make sure that the issues important to the people who lived there were presented to those who would hold office in their name, and that their answers would be held to account as well. Hmm. And these are people who told stories large and small in ways that helped people make sense of their town there.
Well, this morning, Annapolis Mayor Gavin Buckley told NPR's Morning Edition about the mood in his city after yesterday's attack on the local paper.
We know these journalists. We know the first responders that went in to take down the shooter. So, you know, we are all reeling. We're all very familiar with that newsroom. We can't imagine what it must have been like for those guys to not have anywhere to run.
And yesterday, Maryland House Speaker Michael Bush told NPR's All Things Considered that the Capital Gazette is a significant presence at the Maryland State House in Annapolis.
I have many friends that work at that newspaper, and it's a very small news staff. It's a great newspaper, covers all local news, and very friendly, very good, very, very community-oriented.
David, I'm struck, and I made reference to this in the introduction at the top of the hour, by the grit of this small newsroom. 30 people, 5 of them murdered yesterday, and yet they publish a newspaper this morning remembering their colleagues, but also carrying on their mission. I mean, that is some representation of grit and carrying on the work that has to be done. How did that strike you?
As you say, Anthony, a stirring sense of mission, a stirring sense of resolve, I think very much a tribute to those who were killed. I think that you don't have to look to the New York Times or the Washington Post every day to see people, you know, deeply believing in what they do for a living. This is not just a paycheck. This is a paper that, like many others across the country, where the newsroom is understaffed and the staff is underpaid, and they are resolving to do the best work that they can. You know, a human and no doubt fallible endeavor, because it's meaningful to them, and because if they don't do it, who will? And I think that you could clearly tell from those who survived this trauma and those people who survived it, even though they weren't in the newsroom yesterday, that they would be, you know, damned if they didn't somehow get that out.
Yeah.
And that was the way to honor these people. And it's overwhelming. It's incredible.
Yes, it really is. I want to ask you sort of about the national atmosphere that we find ourselves in right now. President Trump yesterday tweeted that his thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families. But the president constantly rails against what he calls fake news, calling journalists dishonest, very dishonest. He's even referred to them, to us, as the enemy of the people. Now, I want to be clear, there's no evidence that the alleged killer here was influenced by that. But to what extent are you concerned about the current climate that journalists find themselves working in?
You know, this is a thing that we talk about a fair amount. You know, I often talk privately with media executives at major news organizations about this very question, and they don't want to sound like they're making special pleading at a time when there's all kinds of issues and conflict and seeming crisis, real and invented. And they don't want to, you know, look, we've had these major shootings at, at a country and western concert in Las Vegas, at schools all over the country, school children being killed, at the Pulse gay nightclub down in Orlando. So it's not as though it is unique that there should be these terrible mass shootings in a newsroom. And at the same time, you know, certainly if you talk to people who are human rights experts and press freedoms experts, they will tell you that abroad, the rhetoric that Trump offers, the enemy of the people, is suggesting treason, effectively, and that it gives cover to authoritarian figures abroad, Duterte in the Philippines, the leader of Turkey. You know, what Putin, you know, the retribution against journalists experience, with impunity in Russia and in other states, it gives cover for that, and it certainly you have seen, I think, a ratcheting up of the rhetoric against journalists and media, from what they do to them as people. You saw it in rallies at times during the president's candidacy in the 2016 elections, and he stirred it up. And I think it is dangerous for the president to declare coverage that he doesn't like or criticism treasonous, even if, as you say, you know, we have to be very careful not to draw direct ties. I think that there's, in some ways, however, a toxic conversation happening. You've seen publicly, and you've seen this play out online too, where journalists face death threats, where Jewish journalists are confronted semi-routinely with Holocaust imagery and references, and I think that it stokes an ugliness. You know, this person who's been apprehended and arrested had an explicit grievance against the newspaper. He appears to have sued and lost a defamation suit. He appears to have been essentially conducting routine harassment, according to the former publisher. This is a community paper that decided not to try to have him prosecuted, and it appears as though police were reluctant to arrest him, that there wasn't quite enough to do it on. And so we don't know that what Trump said influenced this, but we do know that he has created a national conversation toward the press that is hostile with directly violent undertones, and that that's a kind of negative leadership that I hope that whatever horrible other things have happened in Annapolis, that perhaps this is a moment for some sober reflection by people about, you know, what it means to participate in civic life.
A good thought to end this conversation on about a very sad subject. David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, thank you so much for joining us today. Sorry for your loss. You lost a friend here. I'm sorry for all of the folks at that paper in Annapolis. Thank you for joining us.
You bet. A lot of good journalists and people lost this day.
All right. You can find links to some of the best work of the Capital Gazette and information about the victims at our website, onpointradio.org. After a break, we're going to shift the focus and talk about books and the best summer reads of 2018. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy.
Organist hold fire.
Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Okay, so what are you reading this summer? Unfold that towel, open that beach umbrella, adjust that big floppy hat, crack open that book you've been dying to get to, because the heart of the summer's here. 4th of July weekend. If you're having trouble finding that can't-miss page-turner, well, we're here to help. We've got you covered. We have a terrific trio of readers. You can join the conversation. What are you reading this summer? What's sparking the hot debate at your monthly book club? What are you looking forward to finally having the time to get to? Find us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from New York is Elena Nicolau. She's an entertainment writer at the website Refinery29, where she covers books, television, and film. Elena, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Also with us, David Canfield. He's a writer and reporter at Entertainment Weekly. He contributes book reviews and also reports and comments on the publishing industry. He's based in Los Angeles, but already started his summer vacation, which is why he's joining us today from Miami, Florida. And David, thanks for taking time out of your vacation to join us. Good to have you.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
And with us from Detroit, Michigan, is Janet Webster-Jones. She's the owner of Source Booksellers, which was a finalist for the 2018 Publishers Weekly Bookstore of the Year Award. Janet Webster-Jones, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Anthony. Nice to be here.
Now, listeners, we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of books, lots of recommendations, yours as well, and you'll be able to find these recommendations that we're going to be talking about at our website, onpointradio.org. And give us a call with questions or your own recommendations at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let me start. David, I'll start with you. You know, we do have this idea. We talk about summer reads and books that sort of work really well for lazing at the beach or for a little extra time. Do you buy into that idea that there are some books that are just made for a summer read? And if so, what kind of book is it?
I do, partly. I think that for me, what I'm looking for a great summer read is something that I can just completely dive into. And I think that when people are vacationing, when they're taking a few hours to themselves, laying in the sun, what they want is something that they can just completely fall into. And that can be a book that's thought-provoking and that just grips them. And it can also be a book that makes them laugh. And it can also be a book that is just keeps the pages turning because it's just an easy read. So I think it can be a lot of different things, but ultimately, for me, it's all about just immersion.
For me, I think it's about taking me away from my usual reality. Not that I have any complaint about my usual reality, but the joy of reading in the summer is like, take me far away. What about you, Elena? Elena, tell me how you define a great summer read.
I think beach reads can sometimes be written off as being breezy or light when, in fact, the best beach reads are the opposite. I think the books we bring on vacation have to be more magnetic, more compelling, more engaging than the books you might read on your commute, because these books are going to be keeping us sitting in one place for hours, sometimes in not so comfortable chaise lounges. So if I had to choose a single adjective that described a beach read, it would be magnetic. It's something that you don't want to stop reading.
All right. What about you, Janet Webster-Jones?
Well, I really think that summer reads can be read at any time. Not all people have a chance to go to the beach or sit in a lounge chair for long hours. But there are books that you can dive into. I agree with David that you can dive into a book or dive into a subject that you haven't been able to go that deep with at other times of the year. So I suggest that people read what they want to read, regardless of what the season is.
All right. Well, that sounds like good advice. So let's go through some of your top choices. I'm just going to go around this round table that we have that is spread out across the country. David, let me start with you. What's on top of your you've all brought a list of sort of your top five books. So let's take them one at a time. What's your number one summer read, David?
My number one summer read is a sweeping novel called The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. This is a book that sort of snuck up on me and my colleagues at Entertainment Weekly. She's previously the author of a novel called The 100-Year House. This book, for me, is a quintessential summer read, not because it's breezy, not because it's easy, but because it just draws you into this complete world. And it is just completely satisfying and fascinating. And also just totally intimate.
Well, it sounds great. So that's The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. Okay, that's great. Now, David, you have a bit of a reading for us from this book?
I sure do.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of it.
Great. This is the third-person narrator about the primary character, whose name is Yale. When was the last time he'd yelled? He'd yelled at Cubs games. He'd yelled at Charlie when they were breaking up. But he hadn't yelled about AIDS. He hadn't yelled at the government. He hadn't yelled at the forces that denied Katsu Tatami health insurance, at the county hospital system that had made Katsu wait 2 weeks for a bed when he couldn't breathe, and then let him die on a ward that smelled like urine. He hadn't yelled yet at this new mayor and his lip service. He hadn't yelled at the universe.
All right, that's David Canfield reading his top summer read, The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. Elena, let me come to you. What's on top of your list?
My favorite book of the year, and thus my top choice for a beach read, too, is Circe by Madeline Miller.
Circe. Okay.
Yes. Right. Circe.
Got it.
Yeah, spelled C-I-R-C-E. So Madeline Miller has a knack for making the oldest stories we tell seem new again. Her first book, The Song of Achilles, retold the Trojan War through Achilles' companion's eyes, and she performs the same magic with Circe, which is the story of the goddess and witch with whom Odysseus and his men stay for a year in the Odyssey. But in Miller's rendering, Circe is more than just the witch who turned Odysseus' men into pigs. She has an entire fascinating life of her own, which begins when she's the odd nymph out in her father's kingdom, and she comes to own in her
powers. I love it, the odd nymph out.
She is. Good. Yes, because she has a human voice. She doesn't have a goddess's voice.
So I see.
She's left out. And then she's exiled to her own island.
Okay. So, Elena, give us a taste of Circe by Madeline Miller. You've got a reading there as well.
Yes, I do. So this is when she first is exiled. I looked again into that forest. Yesterday, was it only yesterday, I had waited for someone to come and tell me it was safe. But who would that be? My father, Aeetes? This is what exile meant. No one was coming. No one ever would. There was fear in that knowledge, but after my long night of terrors, it felt small and inconsequential. The worst of my cowardice had been sealed out. In its place was a giddy spark. I will not be like a bird bred in a cage, I thought, too dull to fly even when the door stands open. I stepped into those woods and my life began.
Okay. Elena Nicolau reading from Circe by Madeline Miller. Jana Webster-Jones, I'm going to come to you, but I want to throw you a little bit of a curveball before I ask you for your top choice, because you're the owner of a bookstore in Detroit.
Yes.
So what's flying off the shelves there? What do you see people buying as we head into summer?
Well, first of all, we are a nonfiction bookstore, and we have a highly curated inventory, so all the books fly off all the time.
I'm sure they do.
Which is, of course, not true.
Well,
right now, I have to say that the one that's going really fast right now is Evicted by Matthew Desmond.
Oh, sure.
Which, by the way, is a pick of a book club for our local NPR station, WDET, for the whole city to read. So I feel very proud of that. And those are moving pretty fast. In fact, I'm thinking today I need to order another case of those. So I have to say that. The other one that moves quite quickly when we're talking about leisure and having time and so on, I picked Neil deGrasse Tyson's book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry.
Oh, that's fantastic.
All of you know, I'm sure, know Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Mm-hmm. He is a popularizer of science and astronomy in a big, big way. Yeah, wonderful guy.
Yes, he's an astrophysicist, and he's written so much. He's written books. He has had TV series. He collaborates in a way that's just the same as he says the universe collaborates as well. So I think that's one of those that we continue to reorder, and it comes back regularly.
Now, Janet, do you have an excerpt of Neil deGrasse Tyson's book?
Yes, I do.
Let us hear a little bit of that.
Okay, so what he says is that toward the end of the book, because he talks about a lot of things, he says at least once a week, if not once a day, we might each need ponder what cosmic truths lie undiscovered before us, perhaps awaiting the arrival of a clever thinker, an ingenious experiment, or an innovative space mission to reveal them to us. We might further ponder how those distant discoveries may one day transform life on Earth. So he takes us to the heavens, but then he takes us back to Earth and allows us to think hard about what we could do as humans on this planet and what might be our future, not only on the planet, but in the stars beyond. So as we look at those stars in the summertime on the beach and the hammock, I have to think about Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Great suggestion. That's Janet Webster-Jones of Source Booksellers in Detroit recommending Neil deGrasse Tyson's Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Listeners, what are you reading? What are you recommending for a good summer read? Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Tell us what you've got lined up to read this summer.
Hi, Anthony. I just wanted to make sure that everybody knows about an incredibly timely book that came out last fall by Kurt Anderson. It's called Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire. And it's basically about how from the earliest settlers until today, many Americans are kind of uniquely gullible in the face of all kinds of flim-flam, whether it's religious, political, or commercial. And I read it recently, and it is both hilarious and kind of terrifying, but it's for a political nonfiction book, it's a page turner. So everybody I've ever recommended it to has loved it.
So this is Fantasyland, a 500-year history of how America went haywire. Tom, thanks so much for that recommendation. Panelists, has any one of you heard of that book, read that book, know something about it?
Yes, indeed. It's a nonfiction book, and we have it in our bookstore. And yes,
of course
it does
you
leave
do,
the books.
Janet. That's fantastic.
I had to jump in there right quick.
No, I appreciate that. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Nice to be on the air. So I am reading a couple things this summer. So I've started off with some nonfiction, with some fiction to soothe my Star Wars soul from this Han Solo movie that didn't do too well. I'm reading the Knights of the Old Republic series. Right now I'm reading Annihilation, which has a strong female lead. The bad guy is a Sith woman who's leading a barrage of starships through the galaxy. So that's keeping the excitement up. And then for some nonfiction, I'm reading a book called The Butchering Art, which I read when it came out, I think late last year was when it came out. And it's by Lindsay Fitzharris, who's a Chicago author living in London now. She's a medical historian, and it's about Joseph Lister and how he discovered bacteria and the tiny monsters, as he called them.
Wow.
That make us all sick. So
and tell me the title of that book again, the last one.
It's The Butchering Art.
The Butchering Art. Well, Alex, thanks so much for those suggestions. Again, listeners, we're going to compile all these suggestions. They're going to be on our website at onpointradio.org. Panelists, let's go around again and do round two, your number two book on your list of summer reads. David, let me come to you.
Sure. So my number two is Calypso by David Sedaris, who has been one of my favorite writers for a long time, and I'm sure not alone in that. His new collection is typically hilarious and personal and strange, but it also is undergirded, I think, by more of a sadness, and it's a lot more personal than I think what we're used to from him. He talks about his father and the distance that he feels, particularly in this political climate, him being a gay liberal, his father being conservative. He talks about his mother's alcoholism. He talks about his sister who died by suicide. And if this all sounds very morose and bleak, it is not.
I'll take your word. No, but I know David Sedaris isn't. He always finds a way to extract a smile from whatever he's writing about.
Indeed. That's what makes him such a special author, I think, for summer especially.
That's great. Elena, what's number two on your list?
My number two pick is a debut novel called The Book of M by Pang Shepherd. I read this on vacation, so it's vetted. It is a good vacation read. And it's also one of the most inventive and lyrical end-of-world scenarios I've ever encountered in a book. So it's a better end-of-world scenario than anything you might see on the news. In the book, people
Now, wait a minute. I have to stop you there. I'm intrigued by this idea, a better end-of-world scenario. Can you give us just a, you know, without spoiling the book, where are we going with that?
Yeah, no worries. I'll give you the premise. So in the book, people around the world begin to lose their shadows. And when they lose their shadows, they lose their memories. So these shadowless people, as they're called, they're also able to shape the world. It's like when they forget, the world also forgets what's possible and impossible. And it allows for many, many different disasters and possibilities to unfold. It's beautifully written, though.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. So that's The Book of M. It's a novel by Pang Shepherd.
Yes.
Okay, that's great. Janet Webster-Jones, I want to come to you for your number two. What's number two on your list?
Well, everybody loves romance.
Absolutely.
And so I have a nonfiction romance book. It's called Enemies in Love, A German POW, A Black Nurse, and an Unlikely Romance by Alexis Clark.
Wow. So tell us more about this.
Yes, it's a beautiful nonfiction love story. Author Alexis Clark discovered that there were POWs held in the United States during the Second World War. And there was a black corps of nurses, Army Nurses Corps, that was assigned to take care of them in this camp called Camp Florence, I think, in Texas. And so the writing is lovely. The romance is unusual. It takes us to the issues around race and class, war and peace, the other being oftentimes the one that comes to the rescue. And Love sort of conquers all in this. I have to also say that Alexis Clark's book is getting a lot of attention now, and her debut work has really informed us a lot. I have a little passage that I wanted to read from them. Can
yeah,
I do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
We're coming up
okay,
against the clock, but I think we've got
okay,
time
it's real
for
fast.
It. So go ahead.
So in this part of the book, it says, she went to bed thinking about Frederick, who in one instance had made her feel like a human again, a beautiful, desirable human, something she hadn't felt since she was enlisted, and somehow she knew she wanted and needed. A German, of all people, made her feel this way, a German in Hitler's army.
Wow. So that book is Enemies in Love, A German POW, A Black Nurse, and An Unlikely Romance by Alexis Clark. Listeners, we're talking about great summer reads. We've got a lot of you lined up. We'll get to your calls after the break. Tell us what you're reading. Give us a recommendation for the summer. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about great summer reads and some of the best books so far of 2018 with three voracious readers. You can join the conversation. What will you read on the plane or the train as you head off for summer vacation? What's on your e-reader right now? I'm talking with Entertainment Weekly book critic David Canfield, Refinery 29 book writer Elena Niccolo, and Detroit bookstore owner Janet Webster-Jones. And let's take a call from, let's go to Elgin, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Go ahead, Elgin, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I just thought it was an interesting subject, and I thought I'd call in and tell you guys about this book I'm reading, Last Exit to Brooklyn by Hubert Selby Jr., and it's just so raw, and like I've never read a book that made me feel like physically like sick or grossed out or like even like sad.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like it's just.
Is that what you look for in a book, Elgin? Do you want to respond so viscerally?
Not necessarily, but I think that's what struck me so much with the book is because like I've read tons of books before. You know, I was reading Stephen King books when I was like 10 years old, but this book is just like it really paints a picture, and you really like feel like you're right there with those people, and you feel sad for them, or you feel like sick at the treatment of some of the characters in the book. I don't want to give away too much, but
all right, we got it. Elgin, thanks so much. That's Last Exit to Brooklyn by Hubert Selby Jr. I wondered if I could just talk about some trends that we're seeing out there. Elena, let me come to you with that. Talk a little bit about, you know, if when you go to the bookstore, what are you noticing in terms of trends that lots of folks are dialing into?
I think in the past year, we've seen a lot of political books. As one of the callers mentioned, Fantasyland, the books that are analyzing how we got here. And mm-hmm. to the same degree, I've seen a lot of books written by former members of the Obama White House and administration writing about their experiences almost nostalgically. I actually read a great one that's coming out in July called From the Corner of the Oval, and it's by a former White House stenographer named Bex Dory Stein. If you're ever curious about what flying on Air Force One is like, that's the book for you.
Interesting. And of course, we've got a book out from Ben Rhodes, former Obama senior advisor, that's out as well. There are also books by former FBI Director James Comey, Hillary Clinton. So lots of books out there talking about, the various routes that got us to where we are today. Interesting. What about you, David? What kind of trends are you noticing?
Well, I think Entertainment Weekly readers, from what we've been noticing, are really interested in being exposed to new voices. If we're looking at some of the breakout literary bestsellers of the year, we're looking at people like Tommy Orange, who's a Native American author. Thierry Jones, whose book An American Marriage, which explores the effects of mass incarceration on a black married couple. Both of these books have sort of broken out. And I think the reason for that is that we're all looking to connect to people, particularly marginalized communities, which over the past year have felt under threat in this political climate. And there's a special need for a lot of people to hear their stories, to be able to connect to them, and to be able to grapple with their reality.
Yeah. Janet, I want to come back to you and ask you for number three on your list.
All right. Well, number three on my list is Faith by Jimmy Carter. Hmm. And I chose this one because, first of all, Jimmy Carter has written about 50 books. Now, that's a feat within itself. But in this book, Faith for Everyone, he says, or A Journey for All, he talks about the fact that he has been able to rely, use, go to his faith posture through all kinds of happiness and disappointments. And that his goal here is to explore the broader meaning of faith and its far-reaching effect on our lives, whether we are aware of it or not, past, present, and future, and in the whole world, that the faith that he has is not the one that he is telling people to have, but understanding that faith is at the core of so much of what all of us do, regardless of how we acknowledge that. So his book, Faith, I think is a very fine one. The other thing is that people are looking for understanding. And in our bookstore, we have nonfiction books. We also have some fiction. We like to go with the bestsellers or with even some new voices, as someone else said, that bring new parts to the conversation. But Faith is my next one up.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Former President Jimmy Carter, 50, I mean, close to 50 books.
That's
truly astounding.
Who knows what he's writing now?
It's great. Let's take a couple of calls, then we'll get back to our panelists' other choices. Let's go to Charles, who's calling from Hamden, Connecticut. Hey, Charles, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony.
Hey.
I have an environmental recommendation. The book is called Eager, and the subtitle is The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. And it's by an environmental journalist. His name is Ben Goldfarb from Chelsea Green Publishing. And it's really interesting because it basically tells you the history of how beavers were eradicated during the 19th century through the fur trapping trade. But as they're being reintroduced to the American West, they actually have a tremendous environmental benefit that could even help to mitigate some of the problems associated with climate change, such as drought.
Really interesting. So, Eager by Ben Goldfarb, which is a natural history of beavers. Who would have thought? But you made it sound really interesting, Charles. Thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. Let's go to Paula, who's calling from Falmouth, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod. Paula, good to have your call. What are you recommending?
Hi, Anthony.
Hi.
The book I'm reading now is My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry. It's by Frederick Backman. He wrote A Man Called Ove. And this book is about a little 7-year-old girl who has a wonderful relationship with her 77-year-old grandmother, who has created a world of fiction through fairy tales to help this little girl deal with being bullied at school.
Mm.
And in this book, I have laughed, chuckled, cried, and welled up. It's a wonderful story, so I would hardly recommend it.
Fantastic. Say the title again and the author.
My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry by Frederick Backman. And it talks about the value. It shows the value of telling stories and the fairy tale she creates and how she brings it to life. It's just lovely.
Fantastic. Paula, thanks so much for the call. Let's take one more. Let's go to Jenny, who's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hey, Jenny, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Anthony, I just read a wonderful book called Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng. It's NG is the last name.
Right. We've had her on the air here. We know who she is. She's Boston-based. So Little Fires Everywhere. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a family drama, and it's essentially two families, one of privilege in Shaker Heights and one of less privilege, and how they interact, their lives become entangled with one another, and you really get caught up in all of the characters. And it also is pinned against a notion of, if I could say, white privilege, economic privilege, that turns the notion of what is a quote-unquote good family on its head. So it's a great story, and it leaves you with a lot to think about.
Jenny, thanks so much for that great recommendation from a great writer, Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng. David, I want to come back to you. What's your number three? What's the third book on your list?
My number three is a debut short story collection called Heads of the Colored People. This is an underrated book that I'm really hoping gets a little more attention and fits into that New Voices theme that I was talking about earlier. Hmm. The author, Nafisa Thompson Spires, it is essentially creating this panorama of contemporary Black identity. And what she's doing here is telling stories that are funny, that are sad, that really run the gamut. But they are just, you can turn the pages because they're very human. Hmm. And the storylines, a couple of my favorites are the way that she depicts these two Black mothers in a predominantly white school and the way they sort of have this building rivalry with each other, the way these entrenched social structures pit them against each other, and subsequent stories trace the fallout from that with their children, and it just moves you so deeply, and it just becomes so poignant and so rich. And this is a story collection that I think sneaks up on you. And I think stories are great for the beach too, because you can sort of take an hour out, complete one, and head into the ocean.
All right. So that's Heads of the Colored People, a collection of stories from Nafisa Thompson Spires. Elena Nicolau, I want to come back to you and get your number three.
My number three is a book called Bad Blood by John Carreyrou. It's technically a nonfiction business book, but it reads like a thriller.
Wow.
It really does. So Wall Street Journal reporter John Carreyrou brings us into the Wild West of Theranos, a Silicon Valley startup which had been hailed for being able to change blood testing forever, until a few whistleblowers revealed through working with Carreyrou that the entire company was founded on lies and non-existent technology. But the most interesting part of the book is his meticulous portrait of Elizabeth Holmes, who's currently on trial. And she founded Theranos when she was 19 years old. It's a really fascinating book about myth-making in Silicon Valley and the creation of it's a good book for the summer of scammers, I think is a good way to put it.
That sounds great. So Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup by John Carreyrou. Really interesting. And you say it reads like a thriller, even though this is
Oh, definitely.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, let's get a couple more calls. Toddy is calling from New Canaan, Connecticut. Go ahead, Toddy. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Anthony. Hey. I have a book for fans of funny books and of P.G. Woodhouse. Sebastian Fox, who is a wonderful author who wrote Birdsong and Charlotte Gray, has created an homage to the Jeeves and Worcester novels, and it's called Jeeves and the Wedding Bells, and it's absolutely hysterical, and the only problem with reading it on the beach is you may disturb other people with your laughing.
Well, Sebastian Fox is a wonderful writer, but I never thought of him as hysterically funny, but you say this one is funny.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful, and it deserves to be up there with all of the best Jeeves and Worcester novels.
All right, that sounds great. Thanks, Toddy, so much for that. Let's go to Patrice, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Patrice, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony.
Hey.
My book, I'm reading it for the second time. It's Learning What Love Means by a French author, Mathieu Lindon. It was translated into English by Bruce Benderson. It's really an amazing narrative, a memoir, growing up in his late teens, meeting the French philosopher Michel Foucault, and sort of building this family or extended family outside his own biological family, which in many respects maybe didn't give him the nurturing that he might have needed being queer. And then it follows his friendship up until and little after Michel Foucault's death in the maybe late 80s.
Okay, Patrice. So that's Learning What Love Means by Mathieu Lindon, L-I-N-D-O-N, I think is the spelling there. So, Patrice, thanks so much for that. I want to go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air. Tell us what you're reading.
Hi, Anthony. I'm reading Leonardo da Vinci by Walter Isaacson.
Oh, good for you. I've been looking at that and wanting to dive into it, but I just haven't had the time to do it. So I'm really interested to hear your recommendation.
Yeah, it's a great book to read straight through, but it's also a great reference book. You can just pick up a chapter and read it. It's also got some great pictures in it.
Sounds fantastic. So that's Walter Isaacson's big, sturdy book. I carried that over to Europe to a friend of mine, and it put me overweight in one of my bags. Jim, thanks so much for that. I appreciate it. Panelists, I think we've got time for one more each. So, Elena, let me start with you.
Okay, so this is my YA page-turner. It's called Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi. She was 23 years old when she wrote it, and it was sold in one of the biggest YA book and movie deals ever. So the book is set in the fictional African kingdom of Orisha, which once had been home to 12 magi clans, each able to perform magic. Magic, though, was wiped out of the kingdom 9 years ago by a despotic king, and Zaylee, the daughter of one of the women who had been murdered, is the only person able to bring it back. Each chapter ends with a cliffhanger. It is really a good page-turner.
No, this sounds great. Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi. Okay, great. David, how about your number four?
I just have to say first that I had the privilege of profiling Tomi for Entertainment Weekly, and I just want to echo that recommendation. She is the real deal, and everybody should be reading that book.
Great.
My number four is a memoir called Educated by Tara Westover. I think readers should think of this as Wilde meets the Glass Castle. It is an extraordinary story and beautifully written. The author, Tara Westover, grew up to survivalist parents, a Mormon cult. She hadn't set foot in a classroom until she was 17 years old. And she ended up earning her PhD at Cambridge. And it's a really moving story about realizing how you've grown up, the trauma of it, but also trying to reckon with people you still love, even as it was a disturbing upbringing, to say the least.
Educated by Tara Westover. Which brings us back to you, Janet Webster-Jones, for the last recommendation of this hour.
I know. I just love all these books that people are saying. The one I've chosen, hard to choose, was A Lucky Man by James Brickley. Hmm. This is a series of stories that are contemporary fiction where the reading really feels like letters to a friend, or that you're looking at the corners of human experience. It was an Indie Next pick book. That means independent bookstores talk about different books and then they pick something for each month. And this was an indie pick for May.
All right, so that's A Lucky Man.
Lucky,
stories by
Jamel Brickley.
Jamel Brinkley.
I'm sorry.
Janet Webster-Jones, we are running out of time, but lots of time ahead of us this summer to get to lots of these great books. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Elena Nicolau, yes, thank you. And David Canfield, thank you. Have happy summers, all three of you, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can catch up with that list of recommendations at onpointradio.org. Have a great weekend. Have a great summer of reading. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.